Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Ed and I'm the host of We Are Jet. One thing I've learned from talking to leaders at JustEatTakeaway.com is that the success of a future-proof business is about more than just profit.
You know, ultimately, we need a planet to be able to serve takeaways on. And if we don't put that P first, it doesn't matter how much profit you make, right? We've got to put planet and people alongside profit to truly thrive.
Listen to how leaders are driving change in a leading food and tech company on We Are Jet.
How did we grow our business internationally? Expand our production facilities. Make new connections and secure financing to go from this to this? We saw the future, and Export Development Canada helped us map the way.
Looking to grow your business globally? Confidently enter new markets, reduce financial risk, and grow your business with Export Development Canada. Discover the export impact at edc.ca today.
You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. We are recording this at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 6th of July. Meta says 10 million people have signed up to its new Twitter rival Threads, but it can be hard to delete. Belarus says the Wagner boss Yevgeny Prigozhin has returned to Russia 2 weeks after his failed mutiny. And the US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is in China hoping to ease tensions between the world's two biggest economies. Also in the podcast, the rocket known as the workhorse of the European Space Programme blasts off for a final time. And a new world record for dance.
Tap your foot to the right side, then the left. Your right foot then goes to the back and kick.
How to do the nutbush like an Australian. It's been dubbed the Twitter killer. Threads is the new challenger to the Elon Musk-owned social media app loved by journalists and conspiracy theorists alike. But Threads has an equally controversial owner, Meta, parent company of Facebook and Instagram. The new social media platform is available in 100 countries. And according to Mark Zuckerberg, 10 million users signed up in the first few hours. But if you do join and then decide it's not for you, it's not so easy to delete your account, as I heard from our technology editor, Zoe Kleinman.
There's an interesting little bit of small print that I think lots of people probably initially missed, including me, which says that you can pause your account at any time. But if you want to delete it, you also have to delete your Instagram account. Now, whether or not that is something that's going to last, I'm not sure. I think a lot of people are saying perhaps it's an initial operability thing, that it's just so integrated with Instagram because you have to have an Instagram account in order to be on Threads. But I suspect that the chorus is going to grow louder, that actually people really do need the right to be able to remove themselves from this app, which after all is a separate app that you have to download. You can't, you know, access it via Instagram, if you like. You have to have this separate platform. At the moment, I have to say, there's no signs of anybody wanting to leave. I logged onto it at 1 o'clock in the morning, UK time. Don't ask me why I was up at that time, but I was. And it was absolutely buzzing. There were loads of people signing up, posting, chatting. It was like, you know, opening the door to a great big house party. And that vibe is still going. It's been the would say, the most significant alternative to Twitter that we've seen in terms of numbers. And the reason for that is that, you know, 2 billion people use Instagram. If you've got an Instagram account, 3 clicks and you've got a profile on Threads. It's a very, very easy way to onboard an instant community. So you get there and everybody's already there, which is something that social networks can struggle with. But, you know, the might of Meta, if you like, and this enormous global community that it's got means that it's not starting from scratch like the other rivals to Twitter have had to.
Yeah, 10 million sounds like a lot of users in the first couple of hours, but I guess a small proportion of that Instagram usership. What would they think would be a success in terms of numbers signing up, and will Twitter be worried?
I mean, look, last year, when things started to be a bit of a roller coaster at Twitter, shortly after Elon Musk took over the platform, there was a rival called Mastodon, which people were flocking to. And I wrote an article for the BBC website about it at the time. And I said it was reporting really high numbers. It said it has had 230,000 new users in 1 week, which sounded like quite a lot. Now, with Threads, we've got 10 million in 7 hours. You can already see that the numbers game here puts it in a different league. But as you say, you know, we are talking about an enormous community, 2 billion Instagram users. And if only a fraction of them go, if only 10% of them go, that already puts it vastly above any of the rivals. And you've got to remember, Twitter itself is influential and noisy, but not actually that big. There's about 250 million monthly active users on Twitter, which isn't, you know, an enormous amount. It's nowhere near the 2 billion, is it?
It's not. But will Elon Musk be worried?
Well, Elon Musk is being quite bullish about it, as you might expect on Twitter. If I was him, I would be seeing this as the most serious threat to the platform so far. You know, the things that stop people from leaving a social network are it's where their friends are, it's where their network is. They don't want to start up somewhere else. Well, here's somewhere where you don't have to start from scratch, because if you're already on Instagram, everybody that you know there is likely to be joining Threads at the same time. It's very instant. There's a lot of engagement. And that means that advertisers will be interested in taking out ads, which is ultimately, I suspect, how it will be funded. Although at the moment, Meta's saying there won't be any ads for the first year. You know, there's a lot of push on Twitter to try and get people to subscribe, to pay $8 a month to be a verified user. There's nothing like that on Meta. It's offering longer posts, it's offering video options. There's not really a lot that you can't do on Threads that you can do on Twitter. There's things like direct messaging, you can't private message people, but you know, you've already got Facebook Messenger for that.
The BBC technology editor Zoe Kleinman. When Yevgeny Prigozhin sent his mercenaries towards Moscow nearly 2 weeks ago, there were predictions that the Wagner boss would soon meet his demise. After all, the Russian President Vladimir Putin is not known for his tolerance of traitors. And yet, rather than fleeing Russia, it seems Mr. Prigozhin is back in his and President Putin's hometown, at least according to the Belarusian leader, Alexander Lukashenko.
Что касается Евгения Васильевича Пригожина, Викторовича, да? Евгения Викторовича Пригожина.
Regarding Yevgeny Vasilyevich Prigozhin, he is in St. Petersburg, Mr. Lukashenko said. This morning he might have left for Moscow or somewhere else, but he's not in Belarus. So, what should we make of those claims? Our Eastern Europe correspondent Sarah Rainsford is on the Poland-Belarus border.
I think the only thing we can say with absolute confidence is that we don't actually know where Yevgeny Prigozhin is, and that there's an awful lot of politics going on now in terms of what Russia and what Belarus are now saying. So interesting, extremely interesting hearing, of course, from Alexander Lukashenko, who has now said that Prigozhin is not in Belarus and claiming he's in St. Petersburg, as you say. Now, I would say that, you know, after about 10 days ago, we heard from Mr. Lukashenko that Prigozhin was there and that he'd offered to let him bed down there, he said, for a while. We then tracked a private jet, which is linked to Prigozhin, and that jet that night flew out of Minsk and back to Russia. And then we watched it over days that followed, moving mostly back and forth between Moscow and St. Petersburg, although quite often the radar was switched off. So it did look like Mr. Prigozhin, or at least people very close to him, may be back in Russia. So not entirely implausible, but also slightly beggaring belief, because of course, as you've been saying, you know, Yevgeny Prigozhin is a man who mounted a massive challenge, ultimately, to Vladimir Putin's authority. And yet it appears, at least, that he's still free. And certainly, according to Lukashenko, Mr. Lukashenko, he is now apparently back in Russia, which is quite extraordinary.
And what do we know about the location of Wagner fighters? We've seen pictures of an apparent military camp being set up in Belarus, but I guess we don't know if there's any soldiers there yet.
Well, not according to Alexander Lukashenko. He's made it fairly clear that, as far as he knows, as he put it, the Wagner members, the Wagner fighters, are still at their bases, which I take to mean in eastern Ukraine, where, of course, they were heavily involved in the fighting there, although they apparently have been taken off the front lines now. He could also be referring to their training base in Krasnodar in southern Russia. Certainly, I was speaking to recruitment centres for Wagner in recent days, and they were talking about still deploying people and sending them for training in southern Russia. So Alexander Lukashenko is saying that they're not in Belarus yet, but they are apparently still welcome there. He's talked about how they can be activated in Belarus at any moment, used to defend Belarus. He's claimed they won't be used to attack Ukraine in particular, and he said that their legal status would be set in law. But again, you know, still a lot of questions, and certainly no actual concrete sign yet that physically those fighters have moved to Belarus, despite those satellite images suggesting that some kind of camp accommodation has been prepared for them.
Sarah Rainsford on the frontier between Poland and Belarus. Well, moving south from where Sarah is, and the Ukrainian city of Lviv sits just 70 kilometres from the border with Poland and thus NATO. Since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it has largely been spared the intensity of attacks seen elsewhere. But overnight, it was hit by what the mayor called the biggest attack on civilian infrastructure in the city in nearly 500 days of war. A missile hit an apartment building, killing four people. The regional governor, Maxim Kozitsky, posted this update from the scene.
We're now digging through the rubble. There are wounded and dead. This is the Russian world visiting Lviv. We'll continue working during the day, digging through the rubble to save, to rescue people. As you can see, Russia's ultimate goal is to destroy the Ukrainian nation. But this war will go on until the last Ukrainian is standing.
Our correspondent Gordon Carrera in Kyiv told me why this attack had had such an impact.
I think it's the fact that it's in Lviv and far away from the front lines that has caused more shock, particularly there, with the destruction of a residential apartment building and some pretty dramatic images of the damage and of people being pulled from the rubble and the concern there might even be still more there. So I think there has been shock, and you can see that President Zelensky has taken it seriously in terms of talking about promising a tangible response to the enemy, meaning Russia, in his words.
Are we seeing more Russian missiles getting through? Because there was a period over the past few months when improved Ukrainian air defences seemed to be shooting most of them down.
Yes, I mean, the Ukrainian air defences are still dealing with a lot of the drones which come through. It's harder to shoot down those missiles. From what the Ukrainian Air Force is saying, that 10 calibre missiles were actually fired last night, and seven of those 10 were shot down. So three appear to have got through, with at least one of those causing that damage in some way to that residential building. So it's certainly the case that the air defences are able to get a lot of the missiles and certainly the drones that are being launched, but definitely not all of them.
We heard quite a lot about Russia running out of these precision missiles and other armaments, and yet they are still using them against civilian areas rather than this Ukrainian offensive in the east.
Yes, it is interesting. Right from quite early on in the conflict, there was talk from Western officials that Russia was running low on these supplies, but they do appear to have been able to keep firing these missiles. And they've had then this increased supply of drones, particularly with assistance from Iran, which has provided them with another option to launch strikes within Ukraine. So, you know, air defence is there, it is working to some extent, but it's certainly not able to deal with all of it.
Gordon Carrera in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv. It is pretty well known that getting around 8 hours of sleep a night is good for you. But a new study here in Britain suggests that sleep could also help you make the most of another healthy habit, physical exercise. And a combination of the two is linked to retaining better mental ability as we age. Our reporter Peter Goffin has been speaking to the study's lead author.
Scientists have known for some time that taking part in more physical exercise is associated with better retention of cognitive function as we get older. But this study found that physically active people in their 50s and 60s who see the greatest cognitive benefits are the ones who also get 6 to 8 hours of sleep a night. Researchers followed older adults over the course of 10 years to find out how different sleep and exercise habits affected their ability to perform basic mental tasks. Remembering lists, both immediately and after a short interval, and being able to come up with words on demand, naming as many animals as they could in under a minute. Standard criteria for gauging natural mental decline and even testing for dementia. Here's Dr. Michaela Bloomberg of University College London.
While generally having more frequent participation in physical activity was associated with higher cognitive performance at the beginning of the study period, after 10 years, if those participants didn't also have sufficient sleep duration, we saw that their cognitive function declined much more rapidly, so that after 10 years, their cognitive function was similar to people with low physical activity, actually. So it would be difficult to say that it completely negates that effect, but it does certainly suggest that physical activity needs to be supported by good sleep habits.
The study comes with certain caveats. Physically active participants aged 70 and older appeared to maintain cognitive function even with little sleep. And Dr. Bloomberg says it can't be ruled out that lower cognitive function leads to poor sleep habits and not the other way around. Sleep disturbance can be an early sign of Alzheimer's, for instance. But the link between exercise, sleep, and cognitive ability is a starting off point for researchers studying a rapidly aging global population.
That report by Peter Goffin. One of Asia's most popular singers, Coco Lee, has died at the age of just 48. Often dubbed Asia's Mariah Carey, she was known for her outstanding vocals and collaborating with some of the biggest artists in the world. Iona Hampson reports.
Born in Hong Kong, Coco Lee moved to the US as a child. She got her big break at the age of 19 when she released her debut album in Taiwan. And over her 30-year career, she released 18 studio albums in Mandarin and English. Coco voiced the lead character in the Mandarin version of Disney's 1998 film Mulan, and her 2000 single Do You Want My Love entered the charts in the US and Australia. Do you want my love? Show me just how much. Tell me, baby. One of the biggest moments of her career was performing her hit A Love Before Time from Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon at the Oscars in 2001, making her the first Chinese-American to perform at the Academy Awards. Brandon Lewis, who's the founder of entertainment blog When Things Go Pop, said she played a key role in bridging Western and Asian music together.
In the late 90s and the early 2000s, she performed with Michael Jackson and Friends. She also did a lot of U.S. collaborations as well, showing that there isn't that much difference and that there is an audience in the West that is hungry and interested. And, you know, I think she'll be remembered for laying the groundwork culturally and musically.
Her family announced on Wednesday that after suffering from depression for a few years, she had been treated in hospital after attempting to take her own life on Sunday. In a statement posted online, her sisters said they hoped her rays of light will last forever.
Coco Lee, who's died at the age of 48. Still to come on the podcast.
Marriage is a right that every other citizen of India has, but not us.
India's Supreme Court considers legalizing gay marriage.
How did we grow our business internationally? Expand our production facilities. Make new connections and secure financing to go from this to this. We saw the future, and Export Development Canada helped us map the way.
Looking to grow your business globally? Confidently enter new markets, reduce financial risk, and grow your business with Export Development Canada. Discover the export impact at edc.ca today.
Hi, I'm Ed, and I'm fascinated with how we work, why we work, and how work shapes our lives. And I don't know whether it's because I'm growing older, but in the last few years, changes in work life seem to have become even more fast, severe, and confusing. So what does the future of work look like? On We Are Jet, I get to interview leaders from JustEatTakeaway.com, one of the world's largest food and tech firms, to find out. And the answers are surprising, thought-provoking, and sometimes mind-boggling. Listen to We Are Jet.
Russia's invasion of Ukraine was apparently an attempt to stop and even reverse the expansion of NATO. It has, of course, had the opposite effect, with Finland and Sweden asking to join the organisation. Finland is now a member, but Sweden's application has been held up by Turkey, which accuses the Swedes of not doing enough to fight Kurdish groups it sees as terrorists. Today, a court in Sweden sentenced a man to 4 years and 6 months in prison for crimes including fundraising for the Kurdish militant group the PKK. I heard more from Maddie Savage in Stockholm.
These tougher terror laws were widely seen as a concession to Turkey, which, as you say, has been trying to block Sweden's membership to NATO. I think it's important to say that a senior court official emphasised today that Sweden's application to join NATO had no impact on the district court's decision, its judgment in this criminal case. Turkey has said in recent months that Sweden still hasn't done enough to address its security concerns. It's also been angry about anti-Islam protests in Sweden, including the burning of a Quran in Stockholm last week. But Swedish and Turkish foreign ministers are meeting the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg in Brussels. So we'll wait and see if there have been movements in those crucial talks between the two countries.
And what are the views of the Swedish public over these anti-terror laws?
I think this has been a big shift in Sweden, but certainly this is an issue that's been in the news a lot. We've got a right-wing government that's very much said it wants to crack down on any forms of terror in the country. And support for Sweden joining NATO is strong. It was a lot weaker before the application was made, but it's been widely seen here as this is a positive thing for the country to try and improve security in the wake of everything that's going on with the war in Ukraine. So I think it's hard to know. We haven't had an election. I haven't seen any polls. But certainly there is a sense here that Swedes want the country to join NATO and that efforts need to be made to try and smooth over relations with Turkey to try and secure that membership.
Maddie Savage in the Swedish capital, Stockholm. Last month's long-awaited trip to China by the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken was seen as a chance to improve relations in the aftermath of the spy balloon row. However, it was somewhat undermined by President Biden describing China's leader Xi Jinping as a dictator. Now the US has another opportunity to go for a reset. The American Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has arrived in China to try to find common ground between the world's two largest economies. So what are her chances of improving ties between the superpowers? I asked our Asia correspondent Rupert Wingfield-Hayes.
I think expectations are pretty low, Oliver. I think this trip is really a bit like Mr. Blinken's trip last month. It's about getting dialogue going again. Dialogue between the United States and China has pretty much been non-existent for several years. This is the only the second cabinet-level official to visit China since well before the COVID pandemic broke out. And during that time, relations between the US and China have deteriorated further. They were already pretty bad during the Trump administration, but the Biden administration has kept many of the trade restrictions and the tariffs on China in place and has talked very tough. And so I think this is an opportunity for them to talk about their economic issues, trade issues, finance issues. And that, you know, that's the beginning of a renewed dialogue. It's not like this is going to lead to any major breakthroughs. And there are many obstacles in the way because, you know, trade relations, while they are growing and growing, I mean, China's exports to the United States hit a new record last year. But at the same time, the two governments are talking very tough about, you know, about restricting their trade with each other, particularly in the realm of high technology.
Yeah, I mean, what are the key barriers that each side are putting up at the moment?
So I suppose from the American side, it is this push by the Biden administration to restrict China's access to American chip technology, the very advanced chips that the United States believes China will use in its military. Essentially, it's trying to deny China access to the most cutting edge chips to use in the defense sector. And the US is also putting pressure on its allies to do the same and indeed to stop supplying China with the most advanced chip making technology to try and also limit China's access to the cutting edge stuff. The other way round, well, China, you know, in the last few days, China has reacted, and it has said that it's going to start in August to restrict the export of two important rare earths known as gallium and germanium. Now, these are, China dominates most of the rare earth industry, and it's used in electronics, in electric vehicles, in batteries, in things like that. So, you know, these are the areas that really will, I think, are very tense at the moment and will continue to be so.
Our Asia correspondent, Rupert Wingfield-Hayes. The Indian Supreme Court will soon deliver its verdict on whether to allow same-sex marriage. It is a proposal that has sharply divided opinion in India. While the government and religious groups have opposed the idea, the LGBTQ plus community is hopeful that the top court will rule in their favour, 5 years after it decriminalised gay sex. The BBC's Arunade Mukherjee attended the recent Pride parade in the city of Chennai.
It's a humid, hot Sunday afternoon, but that's certainly not stopped the crowd. There are at least 1,000 people over here showing solidarity at the Pride Parade currently going on in the southern Indian city of Chennai. And as you can hear in the distance, there are popular movie songs that a lot of people are dancing to. It's really a celebration today of LGBTQ rights as they register their presence and ask to be treated equally, just like anyone else.
Happy Pride!
The fight for rights is louder than ever. The gathering is hopeful that the country's top court will now recognise same-sex marriage 5 years after it decriminalised gay sex.
I want to get hitched. I'm just saying, we want to get married.
Dressed in a rainbow-coloured traditional Indian sari, social media influencer and activist Shayantika was at the parade with her partner Nick.
Marriage is a right that every other citizen of India has, but not us.
I'm in the national capital of Delhi and currently on my way to meet Utkarsh and Kotia. The couple have been together for around 15 years. They've also filed one of the petitions in court, essentially seeking flexibility within existing marriage laws to recognize same-sex marriages.
We basically, you know, fell in love. We had lots of nerdy common interests.
At their apartment, Utkarsh and Kotia tell me what being married will mean for couples like them.
We both want to be parents. We want to start a family. And we can't adopt children and we can't start a family. We can't go for surrogacy.
Jointly owning property or even, you know, things like if there's a medical emergency, what right does he have to take decisions on my behalf?
So just sort of emotional reasons, but also practical reasons, this judgment means a lot for our day-to-day life.
These arguments have echoed in the Supreme Court over the past few months and centered around India's constitution, which promises equality to all.
Marriage is not only a question of dignity, as if that were not enough. It is also a bouquet of rights that LGBTQ people are being denied.
That's senior lawyer Menaka Guruswamy, who argued on behalf of the petitioners. The federal government, led by Solicitor General Tushar Mehta, has opposed the issue in court.
Right to get a particular social relationship recognized as a marriage is not a fundamental right.
There are many who agree with that sentiment. To find out more and their reasons, I sat down with a former judge of the Delhi High Court, Justice S.N. Dhingra.
What is same-sex marriage? It's an abnormality. A marriage should be between a man and a woman. How can same-sex couples adopt?
But why should society interfere?
Are they not part of the same society?
So if they are part of the same society, then shouldn't they have the same rights?
But that's only if they comply by the existing societal norms.
I'm on the lawns in front of India's Supreme Court, and it's a usual day. Lawyers in their black and white attire carrying files, going in and out of courtrooms. I'm also recalling September of 2018 when the court here decriminalized gay sex. The same place where I am had erupted in celebrations. It took over 70 years for that landmark verdict, and activists are hopeful of another game-changing judgment this time.
Arunade Mukherjee reporting from India. Europe's so-called workhorse rocket Ariane 5 has blasted off for the final time after 27 years of launches.
Propulsion nominal.
The farewell mission comes at a difficult time for European space efforts, with delays to the next generation Ariane 6. I heard more from our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
Well, it was a bittersweet moment for Europe. It was another flawless launch from Ariane 5. They tend to launch late into the evening at the Kourou spaceport in French Guiana, so you always have these sort of nighttime launches, a tremendous power as it clears away from the pad, and did exactly what it's been doing for the last 27 years, putting its satellites precisely where the operators want them. That's probably been the greatest attribute of Ariane 5, has been its accuracy. No better exemplar of that, if I can put it, of the James Webb Space Telescope. Probably its most costly, most expensive payload, $10 billion the James Webb Space Telescope has cost. And it put it on a dime, or a cent, should I say, if we're talking euros, such that telescope doubled its life from 10 years to 20 years. So astronomers are going to get an awful lot out of Webb, thanks to this rocket.
So Ariane 5 retired, Ariane 6 not yet ready. What can Europe do if it wants to send stuff into space now?
Bother. The Director General of the European Space Agency, Joseph Aschbacher, even called it a crisis a short while ago. Yes, we do not have in Europe independent access to space currently. I'd put it as bluntly as that. There are a couple of smaller rockets that are still in the stable that can be used. But as we saw just over a week ago, we saw a very beautiful telescope, the Euclid telescope, which is going to study the history of the cosmos, that was taken up on an American rocket, on a SpaceX Falcon 9. And we're seeing quite a few payloads now, sort of prestigious payloads, being shifted across to Mr. Elon Musk's Falcon 9. And even the European Commission is thinking about doing exactly that with its Galileo satellite. So this is the independent GPS system that Europe has. So it is a quandary. Until they can get this Ariane 6 not only launching, but launching frequently, then they are dependent on the United States for their launches.
Science correspondent Jonathan Amos. We end this podcast with what's described as Australia's unofficial national dance, the Nutbush.
They call it Nutbush! Oh, Nutbush! On a Nutbush city limit!
But it is performed to Tina Turner's Nutbush City Limits, and every year since 2018, an event in Queensland, the Birdsville Big Red Bash, has broken the record for the largest Nutbush dance in the world. This year, the dancers put on a special effort because of Tina Turner's death in May. Our correspondent in Australia is Phil Mercer.
Well, it's entered the Australian Book of Records after 5,838 people danced to Tina Turner's 50-year-old hit in Birdsville. This is an outback town about 1,500 kilometres to the west of Brisbane, so one of the world's most remote music festivals. And the rules for this record-breaking attempt are pretty simple, that dancers must move to the music for a full 5 minutes. I'm from a sporting family, more footballing feet than twinkle toes, but the dance goes something like this, that you tap your foot to the right side, then the left, your right foot then goes to the back, followed by your left. You then raise your knee and kick, and you turn and repeat for 5 minutes. And there were adjudicators on watch for these hundreds of rows of people attempting this record. And in the end, after 5 minutes, a new record was set. And hopefully, according to the organisers, they'll have another go next year.
Now, Nutbush City Limits is quite popular around the world. Why do Australians like it so much?
Well, perhaps it's a modification of the Madison, which was a popular line dance in the 1950s. There is another theory that the dance was taught officially in schools in the Australian state of Queensland as part of its physical education curriculum. But for whatever reason, it has become an Australian institution. I get the sense that through replication and repetition, it's quite an easy dance to learn. It has become Australia's unofficial national dance. And this is a classic snowball craze that, thanks to the people in Birdsville, now has a brand new record.
And that was Phil Mercer. That's all from us for now. The Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was produced by Peter Goffin and mixed by Craig Kingham. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
On We Are Jet, I get to talk to leaders from the global food and tech company JustEatTakeaway.com about what makes great leadership and how a positive company culture starts with looking at ourselves.
First impressions are most likely to bring an unconscious bias, because the only thing you can go on is what you see and what you hear right away. So really important, I think, for us to recognize that and be constantly checking ourselves and make sure we're not bringing in those biases into our discussions.
Listen to We Are Jet, wherever you get your podcasts.